More than 40 student activists from a California State University campus gathered via Zoom on a recent July evening to discuss their plans and support for a statewide initiative that will appear on California's November 2020 ballot.
Absolutely. It's extremely important for our future to have more funding and for this initiative to get passed.
We do agree.
Well, here's what he said. Any Prop 13 reform towards the investment of education is long overdue. I'm interested to see what strategies y'all will be using.
So that is a great question. Oh, I see more questions coming in. Exciting. Okay, so ways for more community college students to get plugged in and stay informed and take action.
Everyone, like we need that. Like we want everyone to make sure that one, you speak to your family members, one, you speak to your neighbors, you speak to your coworkers.
Good that now we have this initiative
that big corporations pay their fair share.
There's going to be a lot of misinformation being thrown out there. We need to make sure that they're getting the right information and understanding that this isn't going to be affecting their property taxes. So most importantly, like it's the most important thing that you can do this year, please, is to get out and vote.
It's called the Schools and Communities First Initiative, now officially Proposition 15. As these students discuss, it would raise additional revenues for public schools and local services by increasing commercial and industrial property taxes. It seeks to address what many have long seen as a serious inequity created when another ballot measure, the infamous Proposition 13, was approved by voters some 42 years ago, way before any of these students were born. Welcome back to Adventures in Ed Funding, the podcast series presented by CASBO, the California Association of School Business Officials. In this episode, we'll explore how Proposition 15, the Schools and Communities First Initiative, works, how much revenue will it generate, and how will funds be allocated, who does it impact, and how is the campaign shaping up. I'm your faithful series guide, Paul Richmond, and I'm glad to be back in your earbuds for this exciting journey. In some of our previous episodes, we talked about the circumstances leading up to voter passage of the landmark Proposition 13 and the calamitous decline in per-student funding that it precipitated. The idea to try to reform parts of Proposition 13 is not new. This latest effort got underway long before COVID-19 ever entered our vocabulary. And if approved by voters on November 3rd, this new measure, Proposition 15, would provide a substantial long-term boost in revenues for schools and local services. In the short term, as in between now and November 3rd, it's also certain to generate an intense campaign with a broad grassroots coalition of students, educators, social justice, labor, and community groups, and some businesses mobilizing in support, while other major business and taxpayer groups prepare to spend big dollars to block it. No one ever said raising additional revenues for schools would be easy. Since our last episode, we've had a new state budget agreement signed into law, and we, of course, continue to be in the throes of the most severe health pandemic of our lifetimes. But elections also loom large. November 2020 will be a watershed in many ways. Among the dozen statewide ballot measures that Californians will be asked to decide on is Proposition 15, a constitutional amendment which, to quote the ballot summary voters will see, increases funding for public schools, community colleges, and local government services by changing tax assessment of commercial and industrial property.
So my name is David Goldberg. I'm a third generation teacher in Los Angeles and UTLA member. And I taught, similar to my grandmother, I taught third grade many years. And I also taught first through fifth, actually. Most of my teaching was done in Boyle Heights, almost all of it, and most of it in the Ramona Gardens housing projects at a school called Murchison Elementary School in LA Unified.
In addition to a career teaching and connecting with students, David Goldberg has also been very active with his union as a longtime member of United Teachers of Los Angeles, including service as an officer. And during the past 12 years, he became more intensely involved at the state level with the California Teachers Association. Last June, David was sworn in as vice president for the 310,000 member strong association. CTA is one of the major proponents of Proposition 15. I had a chance to talk with David recently about the initiative and the movement that has been building around it. So, David, as you know well, when 2020 started, there was a lot of hope that this might be the year when we made a big climb up the mountain in terms of securing additional funding for schools that the research indicates is needed. Then, of course, we've had the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic fallout. And so a lot of the work immediately in front of us has become more about just trying to maintain funding levels. At the same time, though, we have this major proposition that was moving forward, Schools and Communities First, that will now be on the ballot. We're going to get into more specific details about the amounts of money the initiative would raise and how, but even before that, I know this is a measure that CTA is a strong supporter of. So I wanted to begin by asking you, why Schools and Communities First? Why is it so important?
Yeah, so I think from our perspective as a California Teachers Association, with this initiative, the gift that it gives us is to reframe the decades of just underfunding and defunding, intentional defunding of public education. I think that's especially clear here when we went from the number one funded state in terms of public education, you know, from many of my grandparents and parents' generation to now last. And as that happened, by the way, the defunding happened, particularly at the same time that our schools became much more made up of working class students of color. And so I think this initiative allows us to put that framing on it, but allows us to also do this in a way that that does it in conjunction with other people. And that's a different thing for CTA. Normally, our initiatives have focused pretty much exclusively on public education funding, which is, we should never, ever not fight around. But I think the way we fight around that with this initiative is gives us a gift that it gives us is we fight along that with along those issues as well as broader societal issues. The defunding, not just of public education, but of public services. And look at this pandemic has shown a light also on, you know, healthcare, right? All kinds of the most basic public services and infrastructure that is not there for our members or our community at large. The other powerful thing about this, because this current economic situation we're all living in during this COVID has really changed everything, but it's also exacerbated, ironically and tragically, even made worse the inequality in this state and in this country that Prop 15, Schools and Communities First, has actually taken on.
We'll come back to David in just a few moments. Plus, we'll also hear from Sa'an Bell, Strategy Director at Californians for Justice, one of the core youth and community-centered organizations advocating for Proposition 15. But first, to help us gain a grasp on the technical aspects of the initiative, we connected with Tim Gage, principal of Blue Sky Consulting and former director of the California State Department of Finance. Tim has extensive expertise in budgets, tax policy, and state and local government. During a nearly 25-year public service career, he also served in both houses of the legislature as a top fiscal advisor to two Senate President Pro Tems and as chief consultant for the Assembly Ways and Means Committee. Tim started his career in the legislature, coincidentally, in 1978. The same year Proposition 13 passed. Thanks so much for joining us, Tim. And with all your experience working on budgets and fiscal issues, I just have to ask first, Have you ever seen anything quite like what we're going through now with the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic fallout?
Well, certainly not like this. But when I was director of finance, it was a bit of a triple E ticket ride for me because we had the twin challenges of the dot-com boom and bust. And then also we spent about $6 billion from the state's general fund to buy electricity during the energy crisis. And so there was a point at which the state actually ran out of cash, which is not a very pleasant thing.
Uh-huh. So you've been through a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of situations.
Yeah. It was quite wild.
Well, so with regard to schools and communities first, you've been serving as a consultant to the campaign. Is that right?
Yes. I was involved in the effort fairly early on with a policy group that was a variety of folks who joined together and talked a great deal about different policy issues related to the drafting of the measure. And so I helped with that. And then since it was filed and then after a signature gathering, I've been helping with estimates of what local jurisdictions will receive and other questions like that.
Well, great. Let's dive in then. Tell us, what is Schools and Communities First? What does it do?
Well, a lot of people may not remember that when Proposition 13 was passed back in 1978, it not only changed the way in which local property taxes are assessed for residential properties, for people's homes, but it also changed the way in which properties are assessed as it relates to commercial and industrial properties. So they're treated the same way currently as houses are under Prop 13, namely, you basically keep your base year value. It's increased by the rate of inflation up to 2% per year, unless there's new construction or a change in ownership. And the problem with the way it's written, and particularly as it relates to commercial and industrial properties, is they don't change hands very often, many of them. And so as a consequence, a lot of commercial and industrial properties have very, very old base year values. And this is at least partially responsible for a shift in the burden of property taxes away from commercial and industrial properties to homeowners. And so Schools and Communities First is an effort to try and change that by requiring commercial and industrial properties to be reassessed for property tax purposes at least every 3 years. And that's actually pretty straightforward because it's the way that those properties were assessed prior to Prop 13, and it's the way that most other states do property tax assessment. And Schools and Communities First would not affect the treatment of any kind of residential property or agricultural properties. So there's no concern about properties that people live in as their homes being reassessed under this measure. In addition, Schools and Communities First retains the current 1% tax rate limitation that's in Prop 13.
And you referenced this, but just to put a bold highlight on it, Proposition 15, Schools and Communities First, does it have anything to do with property taxes for residential properties?
The measure is explicitly written so as not to affect the treatment of residential property. So those who are concerned that this might be something that would affect the treatment of residential property under Prop 13, they don't need to be any concerned any further because it does not.
Thanks for making that clear. And so going back to what Proposition 15 would do, I hear people talk about it sometimes as closing a loophole that was created as part of Proposition 13. Do you recall when Prop 13 was going through, were corporations or commercial real estate owners, were they sort of seeing this as a way around?
Well, I can't really speak to that because I hadn't actually joined the state as an employee when it was passed. I just joined afterwards. But certainly, I think it's fair to say that the general public was not significantly aware of the fact that the provisions of Prop 13 would apply to commercial and industrial properties as well as residential properties. And the reason that some people refer to it as a loophole is because change in ownership of home is pretty easy to track on the part of the county assessor. But a change in ownership on a commercial property can be tricky because sometimes that commercial property is owned by a trust or by a corporation. And so, for example, if the shares of a publicly traded corporation change hands, that doesn't necessarily trigger a change in ownership. And that's what people have often referred to as a loophole.
And so if this passes, what are the estimates in terms of the additional revenues it would raise?
Well, there's an outfit of researchers at the University of Southern California who estimated that, based on assessor records, that the measure would raise in the neighborhood of about $11.5 billion each year once it's fully implemented. But it's important to note that the measure would be implemented over a period of time because the language of the measure includes a specific requirement that the legislature work with county assessors and others to craft a phase-in process so that county assessors have the ability to hire staff and train them, and so that also that taxpayers of commercial and industrial properties who would pay higher taxes under the measure have time to basically adjust to those new higher taxes.
So if we use that $11.5 billion estimate, that would be when it's fully operational in a couple of years?
That's correct. And the measure is on this November's ballot, but wouldn't be effective until what's called the lean date for the 2022-23 fiscal year. So that's a couple of years from now. That's the first year that assessors would be required to start increasing assessments on commercial and industrial property. But the phase-in of the measure has to last for at least 3 years in consultation with the legislature. And the legislature can choose to make that phase-in period longer if after those discussions it looks like that would make more sense.
Mm-hmm. For people who see this potentially as, you know, a needed revenue, especially because of the COVID-19 situation, it's not necessarily pumping a lot of new money right away into, say, next year's budget. It's more of a long-term impact.
That's correct. It's really a long-term investment. And, you know, as it turns out, the way in which it's written is probably advantageous given the pandemic because it's not imposing a new tax burden during this current environment, which might be a little more tricky. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be phased in over a period of years. But that's correct that it's not a source of funding directly during the pandemic.
And then the money that would be generated, how is that allocated? Who would that go to?
Right. Well, it's basically allocated in the same way that the current property taxes are allocated locally, with one important exception, and I'll come back to that in just a minute. So after Prop 13, the legislature, per the requirements of Prop 13, basically said that property taxes going forward would be allocated based on the average of how property taxes were allocated to local governments in the period prior to Prop 13's passage. And so those local property tax shares determine how much a city or a special district or schools get in a particular location in each county. And we decided to go ahead and write schools and communities first so that it would follow that same allocation of property taxes as is currently happening for cities and counties and special districts. And the exception to that is that for schools, that same amount will be allocated or same share will be allocated in each county for schools, but then all of the school amounts across all the counties will be gathered together in a pool, and then those monies are reallocated based on something called the local control funding formula. The policymakers who put this together thought that that would make more sense because the local control funding formula provides for a more equitable allocation to school districts.
Right. And so I want to make sure I'm understanding it clearly then. So because there's lots of information or wrong information out there already.
Absolutely.
About the measure. Because I've heard comments that it depends which county your child goes to school in. Like some counties that have a lot more property tax value, that would generate more money for schools in those counties. But it sounds like that's not true. It's all sent out based on the LCFF formula.
Exactly. Now, the one caveat is that for so-called basic aid districts that receive enough property taxes to reach their target level under LCFF, they would actually get no less than $100 per student per ADA. They're guaranteed that much by the measure. But other districts will receive money in proportion to their LCFF target. So even though the amount that's contributed to the statewide pool for schools and community colleges is determined by the local property tax shares within each county, once that money goes into the statewide pool, it's simply allocated on the basis of LCFF. So it doesn't matter whether or not your county tends to provide a lot of property taxes to school districts or less property taxes to school districts. That doesn't have anything to do with it. And it's also not dependent on the amount of commercial property in your county that will be reassessed.
Got it. And for the city and county allocations, though, that is dependent somewhat on how much property tax is generated in a particular jurisdiction.
Yes, in that particular county, basically the allocation share is going to continue to be the basis for the allocation of new revenues from schools and communities first.
One other important note here about how the additional revenues would be allocated. Similar to the USC study that Tim cited, an initial fiscal estimate by the state's legislative analyst and director of finance notes a net increase in annual property tax revenues from this measure of $7.5 billion to $12 billion in most years, depending on the strength of the real estate markets. After backfilling for any state income tax losses related to the measure and paying for county administrative costs, the remaining $6.5 billion to $11.5 billion gets allocated this way: approximately 40% for K-12 public schools and community colleges, and the remaining 60% for cities, counties, and special districts. And Tim, the new revenues that are generated from this initiative, and let's use the school revenues for example, are those protected? That is, can the state lower the amount that the state allocates from the general fund for education as a result of more revenues coming in from this measure?
No, that's worth mentioning. These new revenues are not part of the Proposition 98 funding guarantee for schools, in that they are in addition to the Proposition 98 funding. And the state cannot take these new revenues, cannot shift them around, and it cannot reduce the funding under Proposition 98 going to schools as a result of these new revenues.
Tim, you clarified earlier that Proposition 15 does not affect residential properties in any way. Another subject I want to ask you about is small businesses, because we have a pretty good sense that this will come up in the campaign, and there's already a lot of chatter out there about it. So let's talk about it specifically. Does Proposition 15 affect small businesses? And a revenue and tax wonkiness caution here before Tim's answer. This may get into some technical nitty-gritty in places, but I do think it's really important for being able to parse the fact from some of the fiction that you may hear when the campaign ads about Prop 15 start rolling.
As it relates to small business, that's actually one of the other areas where we spent a great deal of time thinking about how the measure would work and trying to figure out a way to best protect small businesses so that they wouldn't be adversely affected. And the way in which that's done is a couple-fold. One is the measure provides for tax relief for small businesses and all businesses, actually, in the form of a reduction in the amount of so-called business personal property taxes that they have to pay. Those business personal property taxes are levied on things like equipment and so-called fixtures, and all businesses in the state would receive an exemption on the first $500,000 worth of business personal property. So given the 1% tax rate, that's about $5,000 of tax relief. And then for small businesses, the business personal property tax is eliminated altogether. And so that provides substantial benefit for them. In addition, the measure provides that properties that are valued at $3 million or less in terms of market value are exempt from reassessment under the measure. So all of those small value properties will basically be exempt. And as we looked at the data that the USC folks used in order to estimate the revenues that would come in from the measure, we've been able to figure out that about 92% of the revenues from Schools and Communities First will come from 10% of the properties. And so it's a relatively small number of properties that are going to pay the lion's share of the additional revenues under the proposal. And the reason for that is because many of those are large properties that have not been reassessed for many, many years. And so bringing those properties up to full market value will substantially contribute to the amount of revenues raised.
So it's really the bulk of it's from about 10% of the larger corporations. And I've heard those referred to as like the legacy corporations. Can you share more about who those might be?
Well, it would be large corporations or corporations that own large properties that have not been reassessed at all since Proposition 13 was passed, or maybe only reassessed once, as opposed to the typical home, which has turned over several times during that period.
Mm-hmm. You recently testified, shared information at an assembly budget informational hearing along with some others. And there was an interesting exchange about this thought that, well, won't some of the those companies that are being taxed higher now, won't they just pass that along to their small business renters or to others?
So in terms of the way in which small businesses would be affected, and whether or not these costs would be passed on to small business owners who rent their business property. You know, really the answer to that question is partly that many, many small business owners work out of their houses, something like over 50% in California work out of their homes. And so they wouldn't be affected at all because the measure does not change the treatment of residential property for purposes of property taxes. Secondly, if a small business rents from a location, a landlord, where more than 50% of the space is used by small businesses as defined by the measure, then those properties would not be reassessed until 2025, 26 or later if the legislature sets a later date. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, for the most part, it's not as if small businesses who are renting from someone who has not had their property reassessed for some significant period of time, it's not as if those owners have passed along those property tax savings, because rental rates are set by the market, and that market is set by the owners who have properties that have been most recently reassessed and are at full market value. And so what's been happening is the owners of properties that have not been reassessed, if they're charging market rents, they've basically just been pocketing the savings themselves. And so once those properties are reassessed, then small businesses will basically face the same market that they have faced in terms of rental rates previously. Just one more comment about one of the things I just mentioned, and that is that the way in which Proposition 13 has worked as it relates to commercial property has meant that businesses that are trying to start up face a competitive disadvantage because they're faced with assessment at full market value, whereas at least some of their competitors are facing property taxes that are much, much lower as a result of being underassessed because they haven't changed hands for a number of years. And so one of the great things about this measure is that it will change that unlevel playing field that so many small businesses face in California.
Tim, we really appreciate this tutorial about the ins and outs of Proposition 15. One last question I wanted to get your take on, especially drawing on your years of state budget experience. We know from the recent Getting Down to Facts 2 research that California would need to spend at least $26 billion more to lift per student funding to the level where every student would have the supports needed to meet the state standards. Given that, one knock that I've heard sometimes from friends in the education community is that at the end of the day, Schools and Communities First doesn't go far enough in raising the amounts of money that schools desperately need. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, I think my perspective there would be that all of this will be to the good. In other words, even if it's not quite enough to bring the funding for school districts to the level that we would hope to bring them in order to be more competitive compared to other states, this is a step in the right direction. And it certainly doesn't preclude future efforts to raise additional revenues to schools if the voters are so inclined.
Now that we're all better versed in how Proposition 15 works, let's explore the measure even more in terms of the energy driving it, the coalition supporting it, and more. And for that, let's return to David Goldberg, elementary school teacher and CTA vice president. And David, I want to pick up on the thread that Tim Gage left off with, this question of whether at the end of the day, does Proposition 15 go far enough in raising the amounts of money our severely underfunded schools need? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, there's no one single initiative that's going to get us $26 billion into our public education system. And so if you take that as your starting point, then you have to look at what's a strategy and tactics that we actually can be talking about that. Putting together a coalition strong enough to win not just an initiative, but beyond this initiative, moving forward to move that dial is vitally important. I don't think our unions or public sector unions or just public education people alone are going to be able to win that kind of funding. I think it has to be in conjunction with others. Numbers I've heard, and you'll get more expertise and advice on this, is from anywhere from $4 to $5 billion for education. and $12 billion altogether, and the remainder going to other county and local services. So that's, again, that's not the kind of money we need to get out of this current situation at all. We need investment in all services, including public education, on a far, far bigger magnitude than that. What I do think that this gives us, though, is a reframing of these issues that will can have ramifications for how we move forward. I think for many years, you know, especially with the passage of Prop 98, a lot of these conversations with public education sector folks have been outside and separate from the rest of the folks who are impacted by our state's budget. And I think that's in some ways been to the detriment, obviously, of other people who don't have as much clout as public sector unions. And so they haven't been fared as well. But I think in the end, it's also really impacted us and our ability. If anything, if you've looked at this past year, what's been so exciting about some of these strikes, and by the way, 1 out of 7 of our members were on strike last year. But the way that these strikes and locals are struggling, it's no longer just about salary and healthcare. It's about a much broader issues around curriculum, around the need for more services for our students, the need for have parents involved and engaged in a more deeper way. And I think that really has turned the corner and kind of reframed the role of public educators and public education unions in fighting in conjunction for other broader issues. And I think that's the way, the winning strategy for moving forward on all this. So beyond even what the money brings in, this allows us to kind of be in connection with others in that arena. And I think it's driven by, initially by some amazing, exciting strikes that we've seen coming from our locals that have just reframed, you know, fighting for the schools our students deserve, right? We've been inspired by that. I think it also, you know, comes from an analysis that long-term, the only way that any of us, including public sector, public education workers, win, what we really need is by a broader, much broader kind of coalitions. The kind of investment that we need in public education and all social services is so dramatic and so shifting of the status quo that we can only win that kind of changes with a broader coalition. We've had some amazing victories around Prop 55 and Prop 30 around funding, around just and stopping the bleeding of some draconian cuts, and that was really important. But to really get the kind of deeper investment, we have to take on this just savage inequality that we're all living with in this country and in the state. And the only way we have the political power capable of taking that on is in conjunction and coalition with others. And I think that is that's a big shift in our organization. And I think it's an important shift. I think it's one that I'm happy to be part of and support in any way I can.
And it is a very impressive and growing list of supporters that includes such a wide array of what I would call the grassroots organizations, social justice, labor organizations. I mean, you've built a really far-reaching coalition for this, yes?
Yes, that's, it is. It is. It's one of the biggest coalitions that I've seen of around any initiative. And I think, again, this comes from years of just built up now generations of just devastating disinvestment, intentional disinvestment. Again, I spoke of the way it would happen, you know, and some of the racism and some of the class issues that really motivated this, either intentionally by some and unintentionally by others. And I think there's all this pent up energy and anger and sadness around what generations now of students have and communities have had to suffer through. At the same time, we've seen just a kind of inequality that nowhere in the history of this world have seen, right? And this pandemic, again, even during this pandemic, inequality has actually grown tremendously, where the richest billionaires in California have gotten billions upon billions more, while the rest of us, working people, have really just been devastated.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say is, look, we have a two-thirds majority here of democratically elected leaders in our legislators, Senate and Assembly. I think there have to be other strategies around raising revenue, right? There's got to be a talk there and leadership there around closing some of these loopholes that we have in California that cost billions of dollars a year There has to be leadership on all kinds of levels. Ballot initiatives alone are not going to get us where we need. We need to do that because we need to win over the public, but we also, all of us, including our elected leaders in Sacramento, are going to have to really come up with some strategies for how we deal with now generations of disinvestment in all public services, including public education.
So Schools and Communities First takes on one of the most challenging tax loopholes that there is. It would close a corporate and commercial property tax loophole in Proposition 13. And that was the measure, as you know, passed in 1978. Prop 13 is often considered a third rail in California politics. So what gives you optimism that November 2020 will be the right time to take on Prop 13?
Yeah, look, I sometimes I reflect on the words of Cornel West, who when they ask, are you an optimist? He says, it's hard to be an optimist, given all, you know, I'm a realist. I see the dynamics, but I'm also captive of hope, right? And I think, look, at the end of the day, if we're not willing to take up one of the biggest, single disinvestment in public services and public education and kind of transfer of wealth to these billion-dollar corporations, if we can't take that on, then what are we here for, right? And so I think it's these odds are always long in this. They're going to outspend us incredibly by, you know, $100 million perhaps. And that's hard to take on. And they're always going to do the same thing, right? Try to convince us and working people and poor people to somehow stand up and vote against our own interests in the interests of these billion-dollar corporations who have. This is not an extra tax on them. This is just saying you pay your fair share. Because working people, we've paid our fair share for generations now. We pay it every day. We pay it in our own taxes we pay. We pay it in the lack of services we receive. We paid it double and triple. And yet we pay it, by the way, when our houses are reassessed. We don't get loopholes around that. When we sell our houses or buy a new house, we're reassessed. So we're paying more market values and all that stuff. When I go to Disneyland, I don't get to say I want to pay 1978 ticket prices, right? Which is 25 or 30 cents. Right. That's not an option for me. And yet they're able to pay 1978 taxes. And that has just been one of the biggest scams that's gone on in history. And it has led to just devastating consequences for all of us. And so I think at the end of the day, this is the struggle to have. If we're not going to have it, what are we here for, right? And so I think we have to do it. I think we have to get out there. There's stuff we're learning in every campaign. And I'm hopeful, and I'm a captive of hope, and I'm an optimist that we're going to turn the corner and make this happen.
That's great. And I like captive of hope.
Yeah.
You referenced that the opposition, you know, we're hearing that they're likely to spend tens of millions of dollars opposing the measure. What if you could get, you know, one or two key messages out there to everyone, you know, regardless of what kind of messages the opposition is putting out, what are those key messages you would want everyone to know about this measure?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, I want our people to know that, just anticipating what the opposition is going to say is that we're not raising property taxes for homeowners, right? That's their fear. So I'd always want to inoculate people to that. That's just a political thing. But mm-hmm. The bigger thing is more aspirational, is to really have them envision what it means to actually say that we're not going to value billion-dollar corporations more than we are the future of our state or the total disinvestment, that we're going to say that our kids matter, that our communities matter, that libraries matter, that parks matter, and that we're not raising taxes on these corporations. We're just saying, pay your damn fair share. We're tired of living with this inequity. It's not fair. It's not fair. And our members deserve it. Our communities deserve it. And our society deserves this. And so I think this is an exciting thing that I would tell folks, our own members, and even, you know, the community, is that this is a huge, it's a social justice issue that we are engaged with around inequity. And again, we always continue this. These days are also reminding us continue to put the racial lens on this as well. It is a disinvestment in schools that are more and more made up of kids of color and community programs that more and more serve people of color. And it's whether it's intentional or not now, that is its impact. And that has to be taken on in those that lens in those terms as well.
And my understanding is that a number of social justice groups really started looking at this. I mean, this isn't just a campaign that sprang up in the last 6 months. This is something that's been looked at and analyzed and building the groundwork for several years. Is that correct?
Oh, I mean, there's people who this has been their life's work, you know. There's a gentleman who I'd like to call out, a guy named Anthony Thigpen, who's been really leading this work for since I was a boy. I've known him. We know that we have to bring in new people to this election for us to win, right? We know that we have to expand the electorate. We have to win people over that normally don't engage with this issues. We know that this the people coming out are going to be very motivated to come out. That's exciting. But we really need to touch them and let them know that this is a longer, as you're saying, this has been going on for now generations. And this is not just a real quick initiative that was put together. It's been strategic. It's been people who have been involved with it. And to be honest with you, before CTA, we're proud to be part of it. We're proud to play our role, but this is bigger than us. And we're just happy to be excited to be part of the coalition.
And what can you tell us, David, about the campaign so far? I know that the official proposition number just came out, I think, last week. So it's Proposition 15. But in terms of what we might expect in the months now leading up to November, what do you think the campaign will look like? Have you seen some recent polling? What can you share with us?
Yeah, I mean, I should tell you that my internal focus is so much on what happens, how this campaign looks for our members, right? That's what I wake up every day thinking about, is how do we build capacity again when we don't have the money that these billionaires have? That those tax breaks, they're willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to protect their billions of dollars. And mm-hmm. So we have to have people power. And so what we're trying to do is try to build up infrastructure, first of all, to have conversations with our members around this, but then for them to break out and then have conversations with their families and their community. It's not something, being part of a union is something that's a gift and it's a beautiful thing. But this is where, as a union, this is where we actually really put that to the test and actually build infrastructure that allows us to actually take advantage of that and engage with people more deeply around this initiative. So that's, the polling is always where it's going to be. I think that if you'd asked me, the only way we win this, honestly, is with a movement like Conditions, right? If you'd asked me, what's the polling like on anti-racism 6 months ago, right? It's right. deeply shifted, right? And I think that's the kind of shift that we need around this issue as well. We're hoping to do that within this campaign. There are some challenges, as I said, having this, no one planned to do this campaign in a pandemic where we're all at home, right? That's a challenge for all of us. But that's the kind of conditions we need to have to really kind of win is a movement like mentality around this, where people feel very connected with this and feel that this resonates and will have a deep impact on their lives, as well as taking on inequities and inequality in our society.
So it really is new terrain to be, undertaking a massive grassroots focused campaign in the midst of a pandemic where we can't have very much personal contact.
Absolutely it is. I mean, look, the opposition side is always easy. They just have to create enough doubt to get people to say no. It's always easier to have people say no. What we need to do and our challenge is to really have people believe in this, connected with it, where they can push back on all the lies and disinformation they've heard in commercials and actually say yes. Yes to a different society, yes to a different world, and yes to really taking on any inequality in this state.
Mm-hmm. I want to just circle back to the optimist, realist sort of dynamic, because, I mean, in some circles, the comments I've heard is where people think it's generally a good idea, but they're concerned with at least polling numbers that they say they've seen feeling like it's, you know, it's going to be such an uphill fight, even before you start to factor in the amounts of money that the opposition's going to pour in?
Yeah. Look, I'm not, my job here is not to sugarcoat anything. This is a hard campaign. This is the hardest campaign, one of the hardest campaigns that's been run in California, precisely because what you're talking about, the just invested interests that have made so many billions of dollars off this unequal and unjust tax system that's benefited them at the expense of all of us. I don't think people are right to underestimate our opposition and how much they're going to spend. I think where people can be misled and what I think people should not do is underestimate us. You know, that's the part that we have to put together. That's our challenge. But I think if we do that, I think it can be an exciting, the odds are always long for working people taking on these issues, right? But I think if we do this in a way, and we've seen examples, and I share with you examples, amazing, beautiful examples of collective action. We've seen them recently, right? Mm-hmm. That's the kind of energy we need. And I think sometimes people underestimate that kind of energy. Our hope is to be able to turn that kind of energy into a campaign, which doesn't happen all the time. That is a challenge, and I'm being honest about it. But I think that the coalition is broad. The people are brilliant who are there. I think it's just we just got to get at it, try to make it happen.
Great. Well, and we, you know, we appreciate all the work that you're doing, trying to lead and help lead this important effort. Is there anything else that you'd like to share about the initiative or the campaign? Maybe something I didn't ask you, or your personal engagement with it?
No, I mean, I think, my personal engagement is just, you know, I am a LA Unified graduate. My kids now are LA Unified graduates. My wife, I met her in high school. She's a psychiatric social worker. Many of us have given our lives as educators to a system, and it's just heartbreaking to see it. So I think sometimes we don't even realize how hard we have it here in California. We're so used to thinking California is a beacon of hope in terms of, progressive politics. But this stuff, this savage inequities that we have and lack of public services as well as public education, it's just heartbreaking. And that's what keeps me motivated every day for my own kids and the kids. I wake up every day thinking of how we serve in the state. So I think this is a gift. This initiative is a gift to be part of as an organization and personally as an individual as well.
On one of our earlier episodes of this series, we did a show all about the Local Control Funding Formula, or LCFF. It included an interview with Sa'un Bell, Strategy Director for the nonprofit Californians for Justice. Well, that episode came out right at the start of COVID-19 in March, so it sort of got lost, but it is well worth a listen, episode number 6. I mention this because during my conversation with Sa'un, which, by the way, was the last in-person interview I've had the pleasure to do, we talked some about the Schools and Communities First initiative. At that time, the initiative was still out circulating for signatures. Californians for Justice was one of those many early grassroots champions that David Goldberg mentioned. They also helped organize the student forum that we played clips from at the start of this episode. I thought it would be valuable to wrap up this episode on Proposition 15 by sharing a part of that interview with Sa'un Bell that we didn't broadcast before. One note, I was tempted to go back and edit out some of the unbridled pre-COVID enthusiasm for the year 2020 that you'll hear in the opening question and answer. But for the sake of authenticity or maybe nostalgia, I left it in. Captives of Hope. Let's talk about revising Prop 13 and the Schools and Community First initiative movement. I want to start with sort of a prediction where a lot of people are saying, you know, 2020 has the potential to be another historic year for education funding, in that we could really
start to take a big leap up that mountain in terms of overall per student funding. Do you agree? Is Schools and Communities First the path forward?
Oh yes, I mean absolutely. Like Schools and Communities First has been literally 20 years in the making. The vision for Schools and Communities First isn't a 5-year vision. It was something that, you know, many organizers who started out like myself were really thinking about. You know, how do we sort of shift how, you know, public institutions are funded in order to like better serve like the communities that are in deep need and have had like basically obstacles stacked against them, right? And have been sort of locked out of, you know, opportunities to, again, like move their families out of generational poverty or to just simply like live a healthy, successful life.
And there are some folks that are in the education community that are concerned that, well, if we're going to go to the ballot and go to the voters with a big measure, schools should get more of the revenue. And with Schools and Communities First, it's really divided. The revenue that comes in is really divided among both schools and local government, cities and counties. Can you just talk a bit about why that's important in your mind?
Yeah, I've definitely, you know, heard a lot of the, have seen the chatter around, you know, it's not enough funding for schools. You know, a couple things that, you know, I sort of want to address, you know, is number one is that, you know, Schools and Communities First is meant to be a key milestone to build on in order to create more momentum to fully fund not just our schools, but our local community and county infrastructures that we know are lifelines to communities. And so that's one. I mean, I think, and the other thing is, you know, it's definitely, it's not the $30+ billion that we need to fully fund our public education system. But based on my experience and, you know, also like the young people and the families that I work with, right, Audre Lorde said this, right, that we don't, you know, nothing is a single issue, a single issue struggle because we don't live single issue lives. And I believe that Schools and Communities First really, really embodies that. It's really recognizing that for the communities and the young people who've endured 40+ years of divestment, not just in our schools, but in our public transportation, but in housing. We're seeing the big housing crisis across California, where in 2019, every day, roughly 400 people became homeless every day of 2019, right? We're seeing a lot of like these crises despite, you know, again, California having, you know, the fifth largest resources and wealth in the world. And, you know, I think it's important to recognize that Schools and Communities First is really just about underscoring that, you know, these communities, right, really depend not just on healthy schools, but healthy local infrastructures like public transportation, like affordable housing, for us to really be able to like thrive and succeed in our communities. So, you know, there is that looming question of like, when are we going to fully like fund our schools? I think that Schools and Communities First really opens up this larger conversation about how much California has underinvested in communities of color and how much California has invested in things that actually harm, you know, communities of color. And I think Schools and Communities First really opens up that conversation and really opens up, you know, bigger opportunities for us to get to a place where we fully fund our public schools and where we fully fund, we have actual like funds where we could build real affordable like housing for our communities, and not just like parents and students, but also our educators who can barely afford in many places across California to live in the communities that they teach in, right? Which is, you know, structurally like contributing to the teacher shortage, right? These things are deeply interconnected. They're deeply intertwined. And it's just super critical for folks to put their support behind schools and communities first, because essentially all it does is it closes the loophole that corporations have been taking advantage of and really shirking their responsibility to pay their fair share to our communities and schools.
And that's how we're going to leave things on this July day, less than 4 months until the November 3rd, 2020 election. Thanks so much for listening. And a very special thanks to our guests, David Goldberg, Sa'an Bell, and Tim Gage. We hope you've gained a better understanding about Proposition 15, how it works, and the key motivations behind it. Our series is presented by CASBO, the California Association of School Business Officials. I'm your series guide, Paul Richmond. Tommy Dunbar handles all of our music, sound, and editing. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already, so you won't miss an episode. And if you like the show, please don't keep it a secret. Give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Until next time, please stay safe, stay well, and keep making a difference for all of California's students.